It's our weekly visit with our friend, writer and critic Colin Fleming. Colin, a happy Halloween to you.
Hey, happy Halloween to you too.
We're going to talk about some spooky things today, starting with an author that a lot of people may not know. He didn't publish a lot, but what he did was terrific, and I know that because you inspired me to get a copy of his most famous work. Like I did in college, I waited till the last minute and got it last night. Yeah. So I'm only about halfway through to Walk the Night, but man, is it fantastic.
Yes. You know what I would say is more famous one, you got probably the edition that has two novels in it, I would bet, right?
Two novels and a foreword by our owner here at WZON, Stephen King.
Ah, yes. King is a big fan of both of them. Although he sort of, if you read that introduction, he runs them down a little bit, saying, well, they weren't as good as these two novels, as like what Steinbeck was doing at the time. And I think that's silly, because both of these novels, To Walk the Night and probably the slightly more famous, The Edge of Running Water from 1939, they're not just horror novels. They're not classifiable as any kind of horror novel. They sort of transcend that genre, any genre. They're two of the best flat-out novels I've ever read. And I'd say that The Edge of Running Water is more famous insofar as the fact that Boris Karloff starred in a film called The Devil Commands from 1941 that sort of put that novel a little bit more out there as something that we might come across. The alternate title of that Boris Karloff film was The Devil Says No. So when the devil is commanding you in the negative, you probably know that something less than ideal is afoot.
Well, but in that, they're so atmospheric. They create such a wonderful, it's almost like you're going back in time and you can feel yourself in the middle of a black and white movie while you're reading these.
I think so, to some extent. But keep in mind, it's a first-person narrator in both of these novels. Now, in the second one, the later one, The Edge of Running Water, there's a fictitious main town, and the narrator shows up there because he's been asked to help out a former professor of his. It turns out what this professor is doing, he's lost his wife tragically, and he's trying to reach her. Now, to have a novel work, though, in first person, that really separates kind of like the kids in like knee shorts from like the big boys, if you will, where it's that voice, it's the inflection, it's the command, it's the personality, it's the charisma of the prose. That's why you see so many things nowadays that are just churned out of MFA programs, written in third person, that flat monotone, no inflection, no verve, no vim, no personality. So to carry a book in first person, some of the best novels are first person, you really need to have some chops. And that particular novel has this subplot of the narrator with it was his friend. He had pined after this woman who ended up marrying his professor friend. She had died, and she had a sibling, and when he knew her, she was too young for there to be anything romantic, but now she's helping out her who she calls her uncle, which is kind of like the mad scientist guy. And so you have that going on as well, that relationship. But it's very relationship-driven. So I think in terms of like the idea of reaching the dead, that might be like an antiquated concern as a plot device, although it's kind of a timeless notion, right? We've all lost ones we want to commune with again, but it reads so modern to me. It's almost like Wilkie Collins' The Woman in White from 1840s. But if you read it, really, like if you just popped in some cars and some cell phone references, it's really of any time. So how well these novels have aged blows me away.
Yeah, and why is it that Sloan is not well known to a modern audience? Is it just because he didn't publish that many works?
He was kind of like, if you know the English ghost story writer M.R. James, who was in academia, and what M.R. James would do is he'd invite some cherished colleagues and students into his rooms at Christmas time, and he'd say, oh, I've written a new ghost story. Let me read it to you. And he had his other concerns. And I think Sloan was like that, too. He was employed at Rutgers. He was the director of the Rutgers University Press. And that's where a lot of his focus was. And he did these two books. And it could also have been that maybe he was only comfortable writing in first person, and I don't know that you can do 20 books in first. I mean, you could do 20 first-person books, but you'd have to assume a different persona for all of them. So maybe these were kind of like his standby go-to personas, and it's what he worked with. Now, To Walk the Night is, it might be my favorite book of all time. I read it at least once a year. It's from 1937, and it starts with two friends doing something we've all done. They're returning to their alma mater to go to a college football game. And that is so evocative of going to a game in October, in November. You're there with your buddy. You're recapturing some of the past. You're ducking off like from the main crowd to have like a nip of some whiskey. And they're at the game, and it's going fantastically. And there's this moment where time sort of seems to hit a hitch, where there's like the universe blinking. Something odd is felt going through the crowd. No one really notices it consciously, though. No one really talks about it. After that, the two friends, they don't know what to do, whether to crash at their old frat, get back on the road, probably inadvisable. And they decide to visit one of the two guys' friends, who is a professor of astronomy, and they go to the observatory to look for him, kind of this loner guy, and they find him there. He's dead. He's been set on fire from the inside out, and there are no signs of flames anywhere. And away we go. And the premise of the book, it starts where this character, Bark, who is really the survivor of this story, he is returning to Long Island Sound, to the house of the other guy, Jerry, his father, who actually adopted Bark, to tell him the story of what happened to his son. And Sloan sets it up wonderfully. Just listen to this from the novel. They're out there on by the surf crashing, and they're having sherry. And this is just a passage from it. "And you haven't defined this thing you are afraid of, even to yourself," he asked me when I had finished. "No," I answered. He took a sip of wine. "Between us, we ought to be able to understand it if we think about it a little. I don't want to think about it anymore. Then it will go on festering in your mind and mine as well. I'll always wonder if you could not have told me something more that would make this thing less intolerable." I said, "I don't want to die." Jerry thought this thing through, and that's why he's not alive now. He leaned forward, put his hand on mine for a brief second, and asked me, "Just what do you think living is for?" For him, perhaps for me, it was a fundamental question. Dr. Lister based his whole life on integrity, and he had taught me to do the same thing. Integrity of mind, of will, of loyal to the people one loved. He believed the purpose of life was to live it well. Unless he could explain to himself why Jerry had committed suicide, there would be, for him, a stain on his honor. I thought of a time when he had turned to me during one of the talks the three of us used to have about life and death, and time and humanity, and all the incomprehensible generalities, and said, gravely, "The one unforgivable fault is weakness." Mm. Now, this is a horror novel, but there's a lot of truth in that. You know, when you think about the things that you've encountered in life that have been wrong, or that you've sort of held yourself accountable for doing wrong, weakness is kind of the root of all of it. And weakness is different than vulnerability. So what they're trying to piece together is what happened. So after the guy, the friend, he had been burned to death, they come to learn that this antisocial professor was in fact married to this beautiful young woman who dresses in really awkward kind of throwback clumsy clothes. And it seems like completely unreasonable that these two people would have been together. They come to know her better, but they also at the same time learn that they do not know her very well at all. And she is not what she seems to be. She is not from where one might think a person could come from, and it builds and builds and builds until Bark learns of this family from the South who had come up, and the child, who was developmentally challenged, had disappeared, and they had never found this child. And he starts to piece things together that maybe this is that child, even though she's smarter than all of them by this point, put together. And so the story climaxes in New Mexico, of all places, where Jerry has gone after he ends up marrying his professor's, well, widowed wife, and plays out there on a butte. And then we return to Long Island. And something happens at the end of this book. that is one of the great, I'm going to say top two or three, oh no, you have to be kidding me, that didn't just happen moments in all of literature, where the past, the present, the future, they all collide, temporality be damned, and it freaks me out every single time it happens.
All right, thank you for not spoiling it, because I'm going to finish that book tonight.
Well, I know you have a lot of preparatory work to do since you are being pressed into service as the Patriots' backup, I understand.
But, yes, yeah. I'm staying loose as we speak just to make sure my spiral is tight if needed.
Well, there you go.
Hey, I also wanted to ask you, Colin, you had a great piece that you posted that's on Daily Beast that includes some of your favorite ghost stories. Can you talk for a moment about your number one on your list, The Ghost Ship by Richard Middleton?
Oh, yes, that's a fun one. And you don't often get a lot of ghost stories that are both terrifying and hilarious. I like those ones the best, rare as though they are, because that's how life often is, terrifying and hilarious. And I don't think you can have the one without the other. And Richard Middleton, he had not the best life, very star-crossed. In fact, he was depressed, committed suicide. And this is kind of what he's known for in as much as he's known for anything at all. But a boat, like a pirate ship, basically, docks by crashing into a town and becomes lodged in a cabbage patch. And it's a wonderful story because the residents of the town, sometimes the ghosts can see them, sometimes they can't. And it's, again, that notion of crossing the divide between the corporeal world and the world of the beyond, where they get up to all these Quixotian-like just shenanigans of like, well, you know, I have to cross through here. Let me pay you with some cabbages. And romance has happened between the living and the dead. And everyone basically just eventually adjusts. And you see the living and the dead in this field coexisting. And it's eldritch. It's certainly macabre. And yet it becomes rather touching. Ghost stories we all know. Oh, you're in the rain and you end up at the house and things have happened in the house. And we all know about the academic who discovers some book and in the book is some code that he's not meant to lay eyes upon and bad things happen. We all know those tropes, but we don't know anything like The Ghost Ship. And it's hilarious. And it would take you probably 15 minutes to read it. And if I could recommend a single ghost story to people, that would be the one I'd go with.
Fantastic. Colin Fleming joining us here on Downtown. Great stuff for Halloween, Colin. And next week, well, we'll sort of stay on the somewhat spooky path as we'll talk about season two of the Netflix original Stranger Things.
Yes, I bombarded my way through all of that. And I found it not just very interesting in terms of its touchstones for what it's drawing upon. There's some interesting flaws in it, I think, too, that sort of could have been touched up. And also, those kids at the center of it, they are so creative, they're so imaginative, and I would argue that that has a little something to do with them being from a different time period than our own. I don't think you'd have a gang of kids like that necessarily nowadays. So there's some different things we can learn there.
Looking forward to it. Colin, happy Halloween. Have a great week, and we'll talk with you next Tuesday.
All right, sounds good.
That's Colin Fleming every Tuesday here on Downtown.